a lonely vegetarian, sweep you off your feet like a maid Marian, having fun like a seminarian. Oh wait, you say you're a happy Unitarian, laughing in the wind like an old Bulgarian. Hey, by the way, are you a librarian? Oh, how sweet, a lonely librarian. Oh,
hello, and welcome again to the Mount Kisco Library Podcast. I'm Maria.
And I'm Deirdre. And today,
we have a wonderful author we think that you'll love listening to.
She participates in triathlons. She practices law. Well, not anymore. Now she pens amazing novels. Yes, we're talking about the awesome Carrie Ryan. Hi, Carrie.
Yes.
This is Deirdre Johnson from the Mount Kisco Library. And I have
Maria with me.
Good morning, Carrie.
Hey, how are you?
Good, how are you?
Doing good, thanks.
Well, it's so great to be talking to you.
Oh, I'm so excited about doing this.
Oh, so are we.
Yeah, we definitely are. You know,
I was wondering, did you set out to write more of a horror book or a romance or something with a tragic heroine? Or what was your inspiration or what gave you the idea of writing this particular type of story?
Well, it's funny because I didn't actually start out with a plan to write anything in particular. I had been writing chick lit for about a year and a half at that point. And I thought I was writing really light and funny stories, but of course the title of the book I'd been working on was Dead Bodies and Debutantes, which really should have given me a clue that I was doing something still a little, you know, that I sort of had that dark edge to what I was writing. And then for National Novel Writing Month in 2006, I really wanted to participate, but one of the rules is you have to start something new. And so I had been in the middle of working on this book, Dead Bodies and Debutantes, and I'd had a partial rejection from an agent. And I wanted to start something new, but the voice in that book was so strong in my head, I was having a hard time starting anything else that was similar. And so there were a couple of different things that sort of all happened at once. First, I had been talking to my fiancé about a zombie world of post-zombie apocalypse, and I had wanted to write a post-apocalyptic book. I had been had this odd fascination with zombies for a couple of years at this point. And so I was sort of complaining that I didn't know what to write for National Novel Writing Month, and my fiancé said, write what you love, and I said, well, that would be the zombie apocalypse, sort of as a joke. But I realized for Nano, you just need an idea and go with it. And then I was walking home from work one night, and the first line came to my head, and I emailed it to myself on the way home. I got home from work, I opened the email, copied it into a Word document, and within an hour, I already had 2,000 words. And every time I sort of had that urge to take it in the chick-lit direction, I was like, no, I want to try this. I want to make this really different. I want to, like, just try a different voice, try a different style, and just really experiment. In fact, the first draft never even had contractions in it because I just really wanted to sort of try and push my own voice envelope as far as I could. And so for me, it sort of came out of nowhere. And I was convinced when I started writing it that there was no way it would ever sell. Like, I was convinced that zombies would never sell. I was convinced that if they would, it would have to be something really action-packed, like The Dawn of the Dead or 28 Days Later. And so, you know, this was sort of a quieter story. And so for me, I was just writing it because I loved the story and I wanted to see what happened.
That's fascinating, though. So did you actually end up writing the whole book in a month?
I didn't. I only wrote 20,000 words. And part of that is I was still working full-time as a lawyer at the time. And then part of it was I don't outline. And so I would have these huge bursts of write. And then I would hit these walls, and I would have no idea what came next. And so I would take a couple of weeks to sort of mope and think, and then I'd be tired of not writing. And so I would sit down, and I would say, okay, what's the worst that could happen? And then I would figure out the worst that would happen to these characters, and then I would write that. And then that would sort of spark me going for another couple of weeks. And so I sort of found my way to the book that way.
Wow. It's still really impressive. I can't believe people even try to do this in November.
I know. Well, it's interesting because now that I write full-time, writing 2,000 words a day, which would get you 50,000, like, you know, it doesn't seem as much as a stretch as it was before. I mean, I think what's impressive are the people who work full-time and then come home and still can every day put in 1,500 to 2,500 words because, you know, sometimes you get home from work and you're just done. You know, you're emotionally exhausted, you're physically exhausted. And so I'm impressed at the people who do that on top of everything else you have to sort of take care of in life.
Yeah,
that's definitely true. Okay, so I like to ask every author this. For some reason, I'm very interested in names and how authors come up with character names. So how did you come up with the names for your characters?
That's a good question. Mary, I think, was straightforward. For me, it was when I sat down to write her, I had that little bit of the religion in there right from the very beginning. Like that, the opening of the book is exactly how I wrote it. And so I wanted to use a religious name because I knew this would be a religious society. And so Mary is such a strong female name in the Bible that sort of came to me pretty clearly. But that was also before I realized that I wanted to sort of continue that through the other characters. And so when I had Travis, I just was trying to think of a strong name. And I actually had a friend in high school whose older brother, very cute older brother, his name was Travis. And so that came into my head. And then for Harry, I wanted a name that was sort of not your traditional strong, you know, like, I guess I had read a long time ago, I used to write romance novels and read a bunch of romance novels, that names that have like that very strong T, like Travis and Steve and those kinds of names are very strong names.
Uh-huh.
And I thought Harry wasn't as strong of a name, or Harold, you know, it wasn't for your traditional romance name. And I didn't realize until much farther that how often I talked about Mary marrying Harry. And I thought I was just going to use it as a placeholder, but I became so used to them. Jed is named after, I had a friend who had that name, and I always thought it sounded somewhat biblical, even if it's not. And I have no idea where Tabitha came from. That came out of nowhere. Gabrielle came after the angel Gabriel.
I was wondering about Tabitha, actually, myself, the name, because I was like, well, gee, many people name their cats Tabitha. I wonder if Carrie likes cats.
Oh, I do like cats, for sure. I have two of them who keep me lots of company during the day. Yeah, I wish I knew where that name came from, because it's just not a name you run into, you know, or at least it's not one that I run into that much. I'm not someone who has to have the perfect name when I'm writing. I just need a name to sort of placehold. And I always say it'll be a placeholder, and then it always ends up sticking. And in fact, in the second book, there's a character who I, and she's an important character, that I struggled with the name so much that even in line edits, I was willing to change it. And she's the point of view character for the third book, so I knew that, like, I knew she really had to have a good name, but I hadn't written a third book yet, and so I hadn't really gotten to know her well enough to know her name. So that was, I think that's been my biggest struggle with names so far.
Wow. Yeah, very interesting, I think.
Yeah. Fascinating, especially what you said about Harry. I'm sure that will be fascinating for many people who have gone through the Harry Potter craze.
Well, that's true. You know, it's funny. That's the first time I've ever thought about that connection, because I'm sitting here thinking, oh gosh, I hope someone's going to say, you know, they're going to be married and their boyfriend's going to be named Harry and they're going to hate me forever for saying that. But I also, you know, one of the things that I really wanted in that love triangle or quadrangle, however you want to call it, is that I wanted them both to be possible choices.
Right, yeah.
And so, like, I didn't want to set it up to be, here's this obvious choice, and here's the one that, like, clearly you don't want this choice. But I also want them to be very different people.
Mm-hmm, yes. Which is an amazing way to do it, yeah. I like not obvious.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember the name of the movie. I think it's Sweet Home Alabama with Reese Witherspoon. And she's got a love triangle where they are both actually really fantastic choices. And I just remember the first time I saw that, realizing that if you have, you know, so often the triangle is a really obvious, great, loving guy, and then just sort of a not a very nice guy who doesn't really respect the woman that much, who doesn't really see everything to be seen in her. And I realized that's not a difficult choice. I mean, it might be because you have feelings and involved in both, but the really difficult choice is when you have two fantastic people who are just offering you different options for the future. And I think an edit, some of that got taken out, but I really wanted it to be that Harry was a comfortable choice. It was a good choice and a very secure choice, and she just had to decide if she wanted that comfortable security or if she wanted this sort of, like, someone who was going to support, you know, these dreams of hers.
Right.
Yeah, and I like how that runs through just about till the end, where she's kind of maybe second guessing her choice to go out into the forest. You know, she
yeah.
wants to turn around, and she questions whether she should just turn around and go back to Harry and kind
right,
of have
right.
that life together.
Well, and that was my hope. And it's funny, there's one line that got taken out in edits that I didn't realize was going to have a big impact. And it was a line basically when she and Travis are in the house together. I forget exactly how it went, but it was something about the amount of time they spent together, because they spent a lot of time together in that house.
Mm-hmm.
And I think everyone involved in the editing process was so aware of her spending so much time with him that when we took a line out referencing it, we didn't realize that to an outside reader, those scenes read like she's not spending time with him. And so it's been interesting seeing reviews and feedback, because I've seen people who are so angry at her because they're like, you finally are alone in this house with Travis. Why are you not spending all of your time with him? And I think on the one hand, that's not the easiest answer, because I saw someone respond and say, you know, sometimes you get what you think you always wanted and you realize it's not necessarily what you wanted. So I thought was an interesting take on it.
Mm.
Yeah. So I don't know. It's been interesting seeing how people relate to that, to those moments in the book. Sorry, I take you off on tangents.
No, no, this is really interesting. It is really interesting. Because the characters are very strong and they have a lot of depth, and they can support conversations like this just the way real people could, which is
yeah.
one of the things I really enjoyed about the book.
Thank you. So, I think sometimes it's hard to remember that they're also teens, you know?
Yeah, right.
They're forced to grow up pretty fast, but they still, you know, you still make decisions based off your passions, and you still make decisions that may not be the decisions you would make as an adult.
Right, right,
right. I was wondering about that, like, if you happen to know exactly how old the characters are.
I think in my head they were around 16, 17. I mean, I think they were younger than other people realized, and I never said for sure just for that reason.
Right.
Mm-hmm. But also, in their world, they were just forced to grow up a lot faster. You know, when you think about reading Regency romances or just reading any book, even the beginning of American history, people at 16 and 17 were considered adults.
Yes.
So that's where I was, you know, for her, I thought, if in your head she needed to be 17 or 18, because I think in the script for the movie they have her at like 20, because that's just easier to deal with the society that we know now. You know, it's harder to sort of think of seeing a 16-year-old making these decisions, but in her world, that was fairly grown up.
Yes. I kind of imagined her to be that age, I guess because I have read a lot of historical diaries and things, and it did seem very true to life in that kind of frontier way.
Mm-hmm, exactly, yeah.
The other thing I was wondering about is, where did you come up with this sisterhood? This is a... kind of an amazing social construct, and they seem to really rule everything.
Well, and that was in the very beginning when I was writing it. I knew I had a sisterhood, and it wasn't all women in the scene right when her mother is infected and they go into the cathedral. There's a priest, and then I was just sort of sitting one day thinking about it, and it was just sort of what I had written, because in the churches I'd grown up with, that was the way our churches were. You know, we had the male priest. And then I was thinking more about how this village would have formed and how it would be ruled. And I realized that I really liked the idea of this really strong, female-dominated theocracy. And it really flowed somewhat organically. And I didn't want them to be considered evil. And part of that was in edits, I did play that up a little bit more. But I think one of my favorite scenes in the book, which is sort of such an odd and small scene to really like, is the scene, and I'm hopefully not giving away any spoilers to anyone who would be listening, but during the breach when Sister Tabitha holds the door for Mary. And in that scene, I was just writing it, and I sort of lose myself when I'm writing. I'm seeing it all happen in my head,
mm-hmm.
and this is what's happening, and I'm writing it. And just that moment where she waits to save Mary. And, you know, this whole time Mary has sort of, I think, looked at her as someone who's just always stood in the way and who's just rigid in a very unnecessary way and holding secrets and all of these things. And then that moment, what that meant to me was Sister Tabitha's still trying to save her, because that's what's important to her. Like, that's what's important to sisterhood, is that everyone survives. And I think it's done out of a really deep abiding love for all of the people in that village. And then she gets bitten and she sacrifices herself, because that's what I think she and a lot of sisters have done over the years, is they've sacrificed their own happiness and their own wants for this village. And so I didn't want it to be this sort of this easy, we're in charge, we get to do what we want. Like, I really do think that they feel like the secrets that they're keeping and the information they're holding back and that their rules are there out of love, and they're done to protect this village and to sort of keep everyone alive. That's such a small point to rest all of that on, but I really do think that for her, it was not to be mean or because she liked having control. Like, I really think a lot of it was done out of love. And she might have been misguided in it. You know, I think from Mary's point of view, and that's the only point of view we have, the sisterhood is very misguided, but I think people make decisions for other people all of the time, and they're difficult to do.
Uh-huh. That's very illuminating, because certain scenes with Tabitha, you really think, oh my God, this woman is evil.
Yeah.
But then, as you say, there are those other things.
Part of that is, you know, there are people who withhold information, important information, for us to make decisions. I don't ever like getting political about things, but you look at the history of government in any country, and you have, regardless of whether the government is somewhat open or somewhat closed, controlling the information is controlling the people. But if you don't let the people have all of the information come to their own decision, then you get to make the decision for them.
Right.
And so part of that was Mary trying to say, okay, if we're going to make our own decisions, we have to have the information. But if people in the village knew there was an outside world, and they went out into the world, and the outside world would learn of the village. And in a world that's falling apart, any place that's safe is subject to outsiders coming in and trying to take it over, like bandits.
Whoa. That's grim, grim, grim.
Oh, I know, I know.
Yeah.
I know.
Definitely post-apocalyptic. I can't say
yes.
That word.
Yeah, it's in my manuscript to my agent, and he's always like, another story full of sunshine and light. But it's a harsh world, you know.
Oh, it is. Which takes us back, I guess, to the characters, because they have that kind of intensity of teenagers with the kind of need to survive that makes them a little bit older. So they're very fascinating.
Oh, thanks. Well, and it's also a really harsh world. I think sometimes one of the criticisms of Mary is that she is selfish. And it's funny how some people will say she wasn't selfish at all, and some people will say she was just too selfish for me. I would love to know, when you make that determination, sort of what experience you're coming from, because, you know, my mom always used to say, if there's something that you don't like in a person, then you're looking in a mirror.
Ooh.
And that you need to find out, yeah, that you need to find out if there's something in them, you need to look at yourself and see if that's what's sparking that within you. And so, you know, I think looking at Mary and thinking about her being selfish, because I think at times she's very selfish, and then it makes me look back at myself and wonder, you know, what is there within me that that's resonating with? And I also think in a world where death is literally on the other side of the fence, you have to be selfish at some point to survive.
Yeah, I think if you weren't selfish at all, then you'd be giving yourself up for everyone, and you'd be dead
right.
Quickly.
Right. Or not just dead, but if you're unwilling to fight for what you believe in and what you truly want in life, then you're letting someone else dictate your passions, your future, every bit about you. You know, Mary's choice was she could stay in the village and let the sisterhood tell her how to live her life, or she could choose to live it her own way.
Yeah. It's interesting comparing her and Cass, or contrasting them, maybe I should say. Because though they were, you know, best friends and kind of went through all of this together, they kind of responded in very different ways.
Right. In the rough draft of the book, I probably shouldn't say this, my fiancé is my first reader, and he finished it, and he turned to me and he said, you know that Cass doesn't say one word for the second half of the book. And I was like, wow, no, I didn't realize that. And I realized that the reason I hadn't had her say anything in the second half of the book is because I hadn't sort of figured out how she was feeling, how she was reacting. Mm. So I wrote the scene where they're on the platforms, and it's the scene where she looks at Mary and she's like, you know, it's always about you. And writing that made me understand her character so much better about how this affected her. And I also think part of that was Mary sort of wasn't touching it with Kat. You know, for Mary, it was all about her and how she was going to survive and what choices she was going to make.
So I have two questions that are kind of related, but I'll say at the outset, you don't have to answer either of them if you don't want to. Okay. I'm wondering how many books you have planned in the series about these characters?
Well, right now there are three under contract. The second one is The Dead Tossed Waves, and that thing out in March of 2010. And it's a companion, not a direct sequel, because it's told from a different character's point of view, and it starts after, like, quite a bit after the end of the first book. It's actually told from Mary's daughter's point of view.
Oh, wow. So we know Mary has a daughter.
Yes. Okay. Right. I think it's clear from reading the back of the flap copy, but you can never be sure. But I think that this world is quite large, and so I could see doing a prequel at some point. And I also have a bunch of short stories. I actually have, I think, three that will be coming out in the fall of 2010 that aren't with these characters but are the same world.
Right. And I guess, in a way, my second question has been answered. I was wondering if there's any hope for a happy ending for Mary.
Well, I'm not going to spoil anything.
Okay, I didn't think you would.
I'm definitely not spoiling anything that's going out on a podcast for everybody else to get spoiled.
No,
but I always joke with my critique partner that that wouldn't it be a twist if everything in the end turned out bright and cheery.
Wouldn't it, though?
Yeah, I have some fun stories about the drafting of that book, so I'm excited about it coming out so that I can then share those stories once people have read it and I'm not spoiling anything.
Yeah, absolutely. Of course. Absolutely.
I just have actually a quick question about the setting. I wasn't sure if, as you were writing it, if you envisioned like a particular place on Earth where this was set.
I think
the United States because of all the newspapers, but I wasn't sure if there was like a particular part of the country.
I think in my head it was sort of the mountains I had grown up in, and those were the mountains of North Carolina and South Carolina. And I never realized that I don't really describe the types of trees at all. And I think that's one of the things that I constantly am trying to work on as an author, is describing more, because I see it in my head, but I see it in sort of an odd way. Like, I don't see the characters. I sort of feel what they're going through. That's why I'm not very good at saying who I would want to see play them in the movie, because I don't see them well enough. But so with the forest, that was just what I was used to. And then I asked my editor if I should add more details about the types of trees and told her what those details would be. And she had grown up in California. In her mind, it took place in the forest out there. And we sort of realized that by not giving all these details, that everybody who read it could come to the story with their own idea of the forest that they were used to in their mind. So, you know, I think I found that when people, if they've grown up in New England, they see a very New England forest. And I'm actually curious to see, and I'm very curious to see how that translates overseas, if, like in the German edition, if the readers over there see it as a German forest, you know, a different type of forest. I think the only thing it requires is that there be an ocean at some point, you know? And I actually did spend a lot of time with Google Maps trying to find a place where there would be that much wilderness, and I give up. So.
Yeah. I guess in the future Mary world, all those trees will have grown back.
Exactly. I mean, it's about 150, 200 years, so, you know, the forest would have reclaimed a lot of them.
Okay. So, I just wondered, maybe you could ask you for some words of encouragement for NaNoWriMo people.
Oh, yeah.
Or I always ask also the same questions. And one of the things that I like to ask is, you've gone out and done something you really wanted to do that was creative and made a great success of it. So what advice would you have for teenagers or young people or students or anybody who might be listening to this podcast?
That's a good question. Well, I think for anyone who wants to write, that the key is to sit down and write. I didn't realize until I was in high school that if you wanted to be a writer, that meant writing. Like, it was sort of before the internet, and it was before you could go on an author's website and see how they got to become an author. And so sort of realizing that that's what it was going to take seems like it should have been a big duh moment to me. Like, duh, of course you have to do that. But it was just really, really eye-opening. And I think when you start writing and getting into the writing world, it's really easy to get caught up in, there's just fantastic online communities and blogging and all of this, and that at the end of the day, it comes back to getting the words on paper. I also, for myself and knowing a lot of other writers, we can be so hard on ourselves. We can sort of turn it into this task, so that it's so easy to say, I have to write. I have to get these words done. And so I try really hard to just change the language that I use to I want to write, that I'm excited about writing, and that, you know, sometimes your life just gets in the way and you don't have a chance to write, and that has to be okay. Uh-huh. It's too easy to guilt yourself and to being upset at yourself for not having accomplished more. And I think for teens specifically, I've run into a bunch recently that there's this great push to publish now. And I think the key is just to remember the love of writing, that if you want to be published, I do think that if you continue to write and continue to work on your craft, you'll get there one day, and it doesn't have to be now. So that's generally yes. Generally the advice that I give. And finally, I was a lawyer. I had gone to law school. I'm actually still paying off my law school loan.
Wow.
And I'm not practicing law anymore. And I was really glad that I did something practical, so that if I need to, I have that I can go back to, I can make a living, that I have that one foot on the ground if I need to, especially when you're doing something creative. But I think for me, when I quit being a lawyer, it was the first time I had ever taken 100% risk on myself and said, you know, this is what I really want, and you only live once, and you know what, I'm going to take this risk. And it means that, you know, if I go back into law, I'm going to be behind everyone else, and I might have to start over. But to me, it's worth that, just to bet on myself, to bet that I can do this. And it was really, it was an amazing feeling just to say, I think I can do it, and you know what, I'm going to put my money where my mouth is.
Great.
I know. That's
that's
a great answer, uh-huh. I think a lot of teens will be, I don't want to say thrilled, but they'll be. It'll be nice for them to see how understanding you are of that and how you kind of did that and have been successful at
Yes.
It's a tough, I have a good friend who's trying to think about whether she wants to quit or not. It's fascinating talking to her because it's such a personal, quitting her job to write full-time.
Mm-hmm.
It's such a personal decision to make, but it's also somewhat, I think, thrilling to be able to watch someone else go through it, because I think it's rare that you have the opportunity to, and so to sort of realize, wait, I might actually be able to do this. It's a very exciting thing, I think.
Wow. That's really great, and it's so funny. Maybe there's a trend now of lawyers becoming novelists, because my
there
sister
are.
And I participated in that worldwide webcast with Michelle Paver, and I
really
realized she had also been a lawyer before,
mm-hmm.
and somebody called up from her former law firm and said, do
really?
You miss it?
What would she say?
She said, no, not at all.
I know. I tell you, it is definitely a thrill to, like, run into people that I used to work with. And, you know, they built a movie theater across the street from my old office building.
Oh, wow.
And it's just really, it's one of those nice theaters where it's got the plush pre-reserved seating. And I haven't gone that much. I went during the day once with my mom at, like, 3 o'clock. And to walk outside into the sunshine and to turn and look up at my office tower and know that, like, on the 46th floor, they're all in there. And it's 3 o'clock, and they're all going to be in there until 8 or 9 o'clock. Like, it was such a cruel thing. I know, it was so mean of me, but it was the first moment that I just sort of sat there and been like, oh, you know. But I ran into another lawyer friend of mine, and he said that probably once every couple of months, he'll just take my website and put it in the body of an email and then say, what are we doing wrong?
Well,
so,
I'm not doing anything wrong, you know.
No. It's a joke, because every one of us always had a dream. You know, somebody wanted to start a golf course, someone else, you know, just everyone sort of had that dream of one day what they wanted to do. And my fiance is still a lawyer, so I still get that, you know, keep in touch with that part of it.
His nature, yeah. Okay.
Yeah. It makes me very grateful every day. There's no day that I'm home and he's at work that I'm not just incredibly grateful for what I have.
Well, wonderful. I think that was really great. And I just wondered before we finish, which we have to do, unfortunately, in a couple of minutes, but I was wondering whether you had anything you wanted to ask us or tell us in conclusion.
I mean, I would sit here and talk to you for hours. I mean,
I would love that.
But now, tell them this. Well, I'm curious as to what books you're finding that you see people getting really excited about these days.
Personally, I think I speak for both of us here. We are terrible Queen's Thief addicts. We're waiting eagerly for the fourth one in that series.
For what series?
Oh, The Queen's Thief. It's by Megan Whelan-Turner.
Oh, I don't know that one.
Oh, go out and
I know. Yeah, we have to go order that one.
The first one is called The Thief, and it was a Newbery Honor book, quite a few years
ago. In 96, I think?
A long time ago. Yeah. And what's wonderful is that each book gets better than the last.
The first one
is good. The second one is pretty excellent. The third one is out of this world. Yeah. And the fourth one is coming out in March.
Oh, really? Oh, wow. Yeah. I have so many friends who love her, and I am so embarrassed that I have not read her yet.
Uh-huh. Yeah, well.
I need to.
I know, you're very busy.
What else? I guess anything really vampire is still really hot.
Yes.
The Mortal Instruments by Cassandra Clare. That's been going out a lot.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, that's great.
Kids are loving her. That one. And actually, I have to say, you debutantes, I said that to, was it RJ? You guys are flying off the shelves, so.
Oh, that's
be
great.
Happy.
Oh, that's great. Well, and that group sort of came out of nowhere. Mm-hmm. And that's been such a treat this year. Even things like someone posting, hey, there's a podcast. Whoever wants to be involved, go do it. Yeah. But it's also like, I feel so lucky to have been part of that group. It's just such great people.
Right. Unfortunately, we are going to have to wind it up.
All right.
Well, thanks a million. This was really wonderful. And I think we learned a lot about your book.
Yes.
And hopefully we have inspired people to go out and read
and write.
Yes, and write. Yeah.
Oh, I hope so. I hope so.
Yes, absolutely.
Well, and thank you guys so much for letting me have a chance to talk about it, because I was just thinking this morning just what a treat it is to talk to people who love books and love, you know, introducing other people to books, because I just, growing up, you know, reading was such a big part of my life, and I love seeing librarians, and I love seeing students who are just so excited about reading. Like, it's just such a thrill.
Right. And, you know, there's a series of books that I was thinking about, just young kids' books, and they're very funny, because the first one is called Alcatraz Versus the Evil Librarians. And the whole premise is that the librarians are the keepers of all the knowledge, and therefore they rule the world. But what I really think, going back to what you said, is that we provide the access to knowledge of anything people want. So we're really the guardians of democracy here in this country anyway. And people need to come see us and get your book out and whatever else they want to read or learn about. So.
Well, and that's exactly, ties right back into the point that made with the sisterhood, is that
yes, exactly.
You don't have access to knowledge, and you can't make your own decisions about your own life and what's going on in the world. So access to knowledge, I think, is the key to, like you said, to democracy.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Absolutely.
So thanks for writing an awesome book, and thanks for talking to us today.
Oh, thank you guys so much. I appreciate it.
We hope you enjoyed this podcast as much as we did. A big thank you to Carrie Ryan.
And please look out for our future podcasts, where we'll be featuring other amazing authors like Nisha Meminger, Pam Beshores, Erin Dion, and Megan Fraser.
Yes, and if you want to get any of the books that these authors have written, or if you have any other information needs, remember, there's one place you can always go. That's right, your local library. See you there. Bye.
The library, it's the place where books are free. The library, it's a lot better than watching TV. Almost everyone.